On this week's FTP, Futurum Tech Podcast, we take a look at Uber's IPO. Is it really a lift for the company? We don't think so. We'll also take a look at the MS Build Conference and SAP's Sapphire Conference. We'll take a look at Google's new privacy focus, which seems a lot like Facebook's of late. And we'll take a look at the rise of drones in the air from the FAA and their predictions for the 2023 timeframe, as well as what Nutanix is doing in the hybrid cloud VDI space. All this and more on this week's edition of FTP.
Welcome to this week's edition of FTP, Futurum Tech Podcast. I'm Daniel Newman, going to be your host today, joined by my colleague and superstar research analyst, Fred McClymont. Olivier Blanchard out today, will not make the show on an airplane traveling home, but celebrated a birthday yesterday, so going to use this show to wish Olivier a happy birthday. But for today, big topic on hand, Uber goes public, and we want to cover their IPO, talk a little bit about what's going on with Uber following their big launch. And then we've got a whole bunch of other areas to dive in. We'll be talking about Microsoft. We'll be talking about SAP, talking about Nutanix, talking about Facebook and one of their founders coming out and talking about possibly breaking up the company, covering all kinds of things. But before we jump into the show, let me just say hello. Let me say, Fred, how you feeling this week?
I'm feeling great, but I've got to say, I'm a little bit left out because I didn't know yesterday was Olivia's birthday.
Well, that's because you don't go on Facebook anymore. So if you were anything like me, you go on Facebook for only one reason, to know whose birthday it is. Because any other reason you go there, it's like a black hole. You drop into it, you swim in it, and you come out dumber for it. Oops.
It is.
Say that out loud.
Yes.
Oh, wait.
Hey,
yes,
no, we can say that out loud. We say that often out loud.
Well, it's like Daniel Tosh. I've never said anything I shouldn't say into a microphone when it's turned on in public. Anyway. I digress. So Fred, welcome to the show. Welcome to another Friday. And everybody out there, thank you as always for tuning in. Before I jump in, got to do the little blurb to let you guys know this show is for information and entertainment purposes only. We will be talking about companies, potentially talking about their performance and even talking about their stocks. But we are not here to offer you any sort of financial advice whatsoever. So do not make decisions on any stock purchases, investments, shorts, or anything else you're going to do based upon the advice or insights or information that you gather here on this show. All right, digging in. Uber, Fred, I'm not going to take a lot of time to do the backstory, but what I'll say is this. Probably about a couple months ago, we did an entire show about the Lyft IPO. So you can't possibly do a show focused on a Lyft IPO and not do a show focused on the Uber IPO. The Uber IPO has potentially been one of the most talked about IPOs in a year full of some pretty interesting tech IPOs. We've had Lyft, we've had Zoom, We have Slack expected later in this year, and now we have Uber. And Fred, it bombed. It did terrible. It came out lower than Lyft, and it's sinking on the first day. So the shareholders, I mean, what happened? I'm just going to jump right over to you. What do you think happened?
Well, you know, there are a number of things. I think, you know, first off, as we dive into this conversation here, our main dive about Uber and Lyft, it's important to recognize that these two firms, they have a, you know, mutually beneficial relationship of a sort and a bit of a competitive relationship, but they are different enough that, you know, when we talk about the stock prices, when we talk about the you know, the market caps and so forth, and the business models, they're different enough that we can't necessarily draw a one-to-one comparison. But I mean, if we were to compare the two, yeah. So Lyft is still sitting down there, you know, about a, you know, sub $18 billion valuation. Uber was originally projected to come out, you know, and people have been talking about this for the last, you know, 6-9 months or so. They were going to come out with close to potentially a $120 billion valuation. That would have put their share price coming out today at $65 a share, roughly. Instead, they priced low. They priced it at 45 at the sort of the bottom end of their price range that pegged them at an $82 billion market cap. That's a huge jump right there. And I think that, you know, recognized that the market right now is not as firm and you know, as hungry for Uber as they thought it might be at this point in time. And there are a number of reasons, just the overall economic malaise, the politics going on, you know, and of course, Lyft coming out and dropping. I mean, if you look at Lyft's chart, their, you know, their price has done nothing but decline since they went public. And everybody kind of associated that Lyft event with, you know, as a preview. Here comes the big brother, Uber, right behind. Let's see what that does. But I mean, Lyft, you know, went from $87 a share down now to $53 a share. I mean, like I said, their market cap is just over $18 billion. So they lost huge on that. Lyft, you know, was a good way to kind of look at what Uber was going to do. They priced low. And I think if they had priced it at 60, they'd be right down where they are right now, you know, bottom of the box. They are 43.66 a share as we're talking right now. Their market cap is under $80 billion. And I wouldn't be surprised if it drops, you know, a good bit over the next month. And here's probably the most important thing I can say about Uber. Uber is a very diverse company. They have interests in everything from autonomous vehicles to, you know, the bikes and scooters to, you know, their supposedly core business of, you know, the rideshare gig economy here. But that rideshare, that gig economy market, that is going to be changing really fast. And that's not the only thing they're into. And by the way, they lost $1 billion in the first quarter of this year. They have zero profitability, you know, within the next 2 to 3 years, maybe even 5 or 6 years for this company, as far as I can see. Sorry,
so
that's my rant.
Ahead of me a little bit, and no, you covered a lot of ground. And Fred, I mean, the financial wherewithal of the company is crap. I mean, they're very well funded, and this IPO will only help them. It will help some of their investors exit, and the investors exited well. Of course, pricing that low may have been, maybe their thought process, the investment bankers behind this thought process, let's go in low and see a nice jump on the first day instead of having what happened with Lyft with a decline and get a little more momentum. But I think it backfired. I think, frankly, they probably would have sold a similar volume at 65. And all they basically ended up doing was driving their price down. Now, again, that's an opinion, and I have no idea how true that is. I'm sure there were a lot of very, very smart little elves crunching numbers somewhere in the back room that decided that this was the right number. But you made a comment at the end. Losing $1 billion, and they didn't just lose $1 billion last quarter. They've lost $1 billion like every quarter for as long as I remember. They don't make money. I talked to Business Insider not that long ago about Slack's upcoming IPO, and their CEO actually came out and said more or less that we don't see any path to making money anytime soon. And I slammed them for that. I just absolutely tore them apart. I called it a bad investment because it is a bad investment. Who invests in companies that have no plan to make money? Now, companies like Facebook, it took a while. Twitter turned the corner, unfortunately, probably trained their investors well to not care about them making money. But in this economy, there's too many companies that are making money, that are paying healthy dividends. And these new companies that aren't making money, these are not cheap buys. Stock at $45, $50, $60 is not a cheap stock. It's not something that people can, the average Joe can buy a lot of shares in. So, you know, if you have the choice to buy Cisco or buy Dell or buy, you know, these foundational companies with high quarterly earnings, or to take the flyer on a unicorn that's losing $1 billion a quarter, it's really hard to advise that. So the business fundamental losses to me is possibly one of my biggest reasons that I'm like, this is a total, total failure. We are in a time where that's been okay in the past, but it seems to me that the trend is nobody's really getting excited about companies that can't make money. You notice in these unicorn stocks this year, well, the company that got the biggest wave was Zoom, the video conferencing company. And why was that? Well, Zoom's doing well. Zoom's got a plan to make money. Zoom's a high scale, high adoption rate, enterprise software that people are using and paying for. It's like, geez, that seems like it makes sense. Let's put our money there.
Hey, you know, if I'm looking at business models, the Zoom model, it's well understood. It's simplistic, you know, in its nature. Create software in the cloud. Sell the software, you land and expand. You give up the free trial, you convert people over to you know, paid accounts, you convert to enterprise accounts. That's a model that everybody knows. And there are a lot of people that know how to make that work. I can't find anybody that really knows how to make Uber work or who can even explain the way Uber works. And you know, don't forget, you mentioned something a minute ago about, you know, the time has kind of passed, you know, for that, hey, we don't need to make money. You know, Uber, I mean, they started back in 2009 as Uber Cab after they kind of lifted the idea from Lyft out there. And back at that point, the idea of not making a profit was acceptable. That was still at the point where the internet was growing leaps and bounds. Valuations were growing leaps and bounds because of eyeballs. all you had to do was show that you could get a lot of people watching your site, you know, consuming your traffic, doing all that great fun stuff, and you could leave the monetization to some other time down the road. And that's exactly what Uber is doing right now. Only they've shifted. They're not talking about, you know, riders anymore. They, you know, they're there, but that's not the main thing. Now it's the hype of AI. It's the hype of autonomous vehicles. It's the hype of autonomous drones. It's, you know, all this hype. You know, I just, you know, the emperor has no clothes. It's the only thing I can say to this.
Well, the emperor's standing there butt naked and it's embarrassing. I don't see it right now. You know, I give the launch day kind of a thumbs down. Like I said, I think they should have gone bigger. I think they actually sort of fanned their own flames. Now, I'm going to take one last touch on this topic. How much does the driver strike or impending strike, which I heard has been somewhat rectified, and they're going to make a significant payout, somewhere over $100 million from what I understand, yeah, which again...
Which I think that's cheap.
It's good. It's cheap, and it's still going to hurt them, though, because when you're losing $1 billion a quarter... That cash is coming straight, is going to go straight to their losses. I'm sure they're going to amortize it over a period of time and whatnot, but they're still going to just, it's just going to add to their losses. Now, what do you think? Like, do you think the drivers doing that at the time they did it, do you think it was part of the reason that drove that IPO price down? Do you think they were able to, because if they did, these drivers had billions of dollars in economic impact on the company. But unfortunately, by doing that, they've kind of hurt themselves because they hurt the company's cash, which could have been the cash that went to them. So it's kind of a big circle. But what do you think?
Yeah, you know, I'm sure there was somebody somewhere who put some thought into the timing of this. You know, much in the same way that I also think that Uber just kind of got roped in to into IPOing right now. I mean, after Lyft went, Uber had to go. They absolutely had to go. And I don't think they could have picked a worse time to actually go public. But, you know, the driver strike and the fact that Uber is now paying out cash, that I think is very telling. And it speaks volumes to a lot of people when you evaluate the company and its prospects. I mean, we've got to look at, you know, look at the management team. We've got to look at the fundamentals on the business model. We have to look at how effectively they can at any point, you know, convert you know, some type of customer related activity to the bottom line, you know, in the business. And they've never been able to demonstrate that they can do that. And in fact, they haven't really been able to demonstrate that this company for more than 6 months at a time can be well run, that it can actually manage all the various efforts that they're into. You know, so they may be big, they may have the name, they may be on everybody's mobile device. And, you know, I'll admit it, I use Uber a lot. In the past, I've used Uber probably, you know, significantly more than Lyft, although that has changed of late. But, you know, this company just has not demonstrated that they are worth what they are worth here today. And, you know, when you look back at this, there are a lot of people right now that got to be cringing. You know, the money they paid, you know, I mean, if you invested money, you know, way back in, you know, 2010, 11, that's great. But, you know, the later round players, they have to be wondering, how long are we going to have to wait for this to actually turn profitable for us? And that's a big thing. But yeah, there's so much baggage around Uber. And even for a company that, you know, if you buy their business model, if you buy the, you know, the gig economy, the, hey, they're not employees, they're contractors, and the agreement that they just struck for, you know, the $100 million plus, you know, payout here, their side of that is still sticking. We still get to call our drivers contractors here. But the interesting thing is we know, because Uber is telling us and the market is telling us, that at some point those drivers, you know, the contractors are not going to be hired. They're going to replace them with autonomous vehicles as quickly as they can because it's much more profitable for them. And I think that if that's even close to as near as we think it might be, that's going to be a huge disruptive force on this business. Massive, massive issues with this particular company. They may have a good product.
It'll be a big one to watch. I do think the leadership change has been positive for them. Getting it to public has been a feat. They are in some diverse areas that they could potentially monetize and become profitable later. I think right now it's a tough one to swallow. It's a tough place to put your money if you're going to pick. The market's already sitting really high and definitely on some shaky ground right now. So wherever you're going in, I'd say proceed with caution. But of course, we're not actually giving that advice. We're just kind of saying what we think. All right. So I have to move us forward here to our Fast Five. And you're going to get a little bigger dose of me and Fred than normal without Olivier here. But I hope, Olivia, your plane is on time and your 17 connections back to Greenville, South Carolina treats you well. Or you could just move to a real city. That would be cool. But anyway, I digress.
Come on, Dan, bring it. Bring it. What's your first Fast Five?
All right. So let's do this. So this week's been a big travel week. So rather than scouring the news and covering the Fast Five, I want to give some feedback from a few of the events that I got to attend. I started the week off at MS Build, was over at SAP Sapphire, and I'll cover both of those. So Microsoft had their Build conference this week, their giant developer conference in Seattle. First of all, very good conference, very interesting. Got to listen to Satya's keynote, with the exception of their big mixed reality experience on the main stage going, the overall keynote was very good. Satya kicked it off focusing on his big topic right now, which is something near and dear to my heart, which is privacy, security, and responsible AI. So before we even start talking about all the technologies and the platforms, that's the big area that Microsoft is building their story around. We care about your privacy, data should be secure and protected, and we need to be responsible with AI. They did talk about the four platforms of the company that they are really building around. And for anyone that's not following Microsoft, potentially the hottest stock on the planet right now, maybe the hottest company on the planet, passing Apple in value, staying there for the time being. But their platforms are Azure, which is growing fast. They're growing faster than AWS was at the same time. There are some caveats there. Can't talk about them in the Fast Five. Their Dynamics 365 or their biz apps business, very explosive. A lot of connections with Azure. Their Office 365 had some really cool things they were showing, especially around conversational AI. More to come there. And then their gaming business, which I do not, we do not track the gaming side of the business here at Future Research. But I am a gamer. I play a lot of video game soccer. So if anyone ever wants to challenge me to a game of FIFA, bring it on. Just tweet me. And maybe sometime in like next year, June, July, I'll have time and we'll go one-on-one. So there's my first Microsoft Build. Fred, over to you.
Yeah, I'm going to drone on here a bit. We talked about Uber and their forays into autonomous drones. But the people that actually track this stuff and have to manage this stuff, the FAA, they just came out with their forecast for the next 2 decades, which includes some interesting tidbits about the drone market. You know, the drone market, we have to break it into two different groups. There are the residential consumer. I happen to have a Phantom, and I'm going to fly it wherever I can, have a great time. That that market is huge already. There's 900,000 owners, registered with the FAA since they started that program in 2015. But the commercial side of that, as of the end of the year, and by the way, they now estimate that there's about 1.25 million drones in operation out there on the individual user side. That's huge. But right now, as of the end of 2018, there were more than 27,000 commercial use drones that had been registered with the FAA, and they're expecting that number to triple by 2023. And it's an interesting thing to watch, because you've got companies like Uber out there, but anybody that's in the retail space, from the Amazons to Walmarts to 7-Eleven, they are all out there, experimenting with this stuff. In fact, there was a news article that I saw, and then I saw a story on online about it, where Baltimore Hospital actually used a drone to transport a transplant. An organ. I don't know what it was, but they literally took an organ from one person, put it into a drone, flew it to the next hospital, where they took it out and transplanted it into the patient. So anyway, it's here. I think the scary thing is that if we've got 27,000 commercial drones out there today, I'm not seeing them all, but they're out there. And if that number triples, we're going to be, ducking left and right as we walk from the house to the mailbox. Fun times ahead.
Yeah, that's crazy. I guess sometimes I think of it that way, and sometimes I think of it the other way, like how many planes are concurrently in the sky. If you ever look at like the aviation map and you see all the planes out there, and it's like, holy crap, that's a lot of planes. But yet, when you're up in a plane, you don't see very many planes. But the good thing with altitude, you can put them at different heights, and they're only a few inches tall, feet to inches tall at the most.
There are some groups out there that, in fact, I believe Intel is deep into one of them, where they're actually trying to create, the drone collision or the drone collision avoidance, technology, the IFR, the friend or foe out there that the military uses and that the commercial pilots use, to just make sure that two commercial drones just don't happen to occupy the same space you know, right above a crowd.
Unless we want them to.
Unless we want them to, yes.
So I'll be on the third Fast Five. So I was at SAP Sapphire and SAP CX Live. Two different events, same location, same company. Sort of interesting. A lot going on there. A couple of the highlights. They actually had Bill McDermott, CEO of SAP, on stage with Tim Cook. And Tim went ahead and launched his keynote talking about if you have an Android phone, just pass it to the middle and they would take care of it. I thought that was hilarious, Tim Cook. You know, in their 10 minutes on stage, not a lot was said. And the partnership between Apple and SAP has been more symbolic than reality, but they are working on some things to build apps for iOS. The big overall theme, though, of the event is with SAP is this intelligent enterprise. Last year, they were super focused on Leonardo, and Fred and I know Leonardo well because we wrote a lot of papers about SAP Leonardo. But Leonardo was a technology story. It was IoT, it was blockchain, it was AI, and it was how these technologies are going to have influence over the ERP and software environment. SAP sort of seemingly has tracked back a little on that story and has come full out with this intelligent enterprise story, which really leads around outcomes. So the themes here at the event were really about moving towards an intelligent enterprise that's designed around outcome-based implementation of technology, which, by the way, is what we've been saying is digital transformation for a long time. The other thing was this is the first Sapphire they had with since the acquisition of Qualtrics, which was a multi-billion dollar acquisition of the experience data company. So a big theme this year was this OData and XData concept. So companies have historically been very good at using operational data, OData, for driving systems, decisioning, utilization in machine learning, automation. But what they've been missing is the XData. And so SAP Customer Experience Live, very focused this year on the XData, the experiential data, on how that data is going to be utilized as part of a company's strategic decisioning, as part of their systems, as part of their really the corporate DNA. That's leveraging technology. So going beyond the operational data was the big theme that I pulled away from the show. Fred?
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, the SAP papers, the Leonardo papers, that was quite a fun time. Learned a lot about...
not because the papers weren't fun. It was just there was that many of them.
So I'm going to shift gears here a little bit and talk a little bit about Nutanix. So Nutanix, they're out there in the cloud space, the cloud computing space. They have some really cool stuff. And I always get excited when I see a company make a move that just fits. And you look at it and go, well, yeah, of course, that's the thing to do. And in particular, when that move involves a couple of different pieces that, you know, are part of the trends that we're tracking and talking about, you know, every day. So with Nutanix here, they have released a new version of their XI Frame desktop as a service, virtual desktop software. And it's kind of a slick step here, evolutionary wise, for the technology. And you know, when you look at it, you just go, yes, this is obvious the right thing to do. At least in my opinion, it is. But what they've done here is they've leveraged two trends. The first is the hybrid cloud trend. Now, Dan, you and I, we talk a lot about that, you know, public versus private, the on-prem versus off-prem issues in the cloud space. And the reality is that, and as we've been preaching for years, you know, unless a company was born yesterday in the, you know, digital native world and the cloud is the only thing they've ever experienced, that organization probably has, and I'll use the word legacy here, I think appropriately, but they've got legacy technology. They've got investments, they've got applications that were designed not to work in the cloud, but to work in the enterprise, in a data center where they have control of that information. And then there's a whole nother group of users out there that for regulatory reasons, for security reasons, or maybe simply, you know, the apps just don't run in the cloud and they don't have the time to actually translate everything into new software there. For those people out there, the cloud is great and they're adopting the cloud. But you know, as we published earlier this year in one of our reports, 81% of we surveyed 500 enterprises around the world and 81% of them were using some combination of public, private, on-prem, off-prem cloud infrastructure. So hybrid is clearly here and vendors need to spend time thinking about servicing that market. The other aspect of this announcement, though, from Nutanix, the VDI aspect, that's virtual desktop capability, the ability to take a laptop device or a desktop device, log onto the device, connect your browser, point it at your corporate server somewhere, and actually in that browser window have emulated for you a complete desktop as if you were sitting in that remote location or the centralized location. It's kind of like when you go into a cyber cafe and you log on to the laptop and you check your mail, you check your Dropbox, you do all this stuff. The beauty here is that enterprises can take their software, any platform, and you can access that through any device. So regardless of whether you're in the Bahamas or Bermuda or Burbank, if you have a laptop and you've got Chrome or Firefox or IE or Edge, and you can get to that cloud, you can access your software as if you were sitting right there. It's a really nice, slick thing. Enterprises love it. But what Nutanix hadn't done previously is they hadn't bridged the gap between the public cloud and the private cloud. And that's what they've done here. They've taken this software and they've extended it from the public cloud environment, the AWS's and the Azure's, and said, hey, look, we're going to bring this into your private data center. We're going to bring it into the hybrid cloud environment. And what's really important here is they're doing it in a way that has a single point of management and control that controls both the public and the private simultaneously. So for these organizations that are living in this hybrid world, this is an ideal solution. Increased security, decreased risk of data theft, and the ability for your employees anywhere in the world to pretend that they're sitting at their local desk accessing all their software without actually having to have that software and the risks that go with it with them. So really smart move.
No question. Nutanix is a player. I mean, it's been VMware at the top of that pyramid, and you've had companies like Citrix, lagging slightly behind, but Nutanix has kind of come out of nowhere, and they're not really a brand new company, but just in the last few years, they've really hit their stride. And Olivier Blanchard, our normal third party, was out there with them at their next conference this week. So be interesting. Hopefully next week when he comes back on the show, we can get his take on this, but I totally agree with you. It sounds like what they're doing to virtualize the environment for an entire and true hybrid / multi-cloud experience is cutting edge. And so them and VMware really do have very complete complementary solutions. And one of the things I think is really interesting, and this is going to be the take, because we work with Dell, and Dell's someone I have a lot of respect for their business, that VMware was a great purchase. But do companies like HPE, like Cisco, like IBM, that aren't necessarily completely playing in the spaces that VMware was playing in, that maybe had historically worked with VMware, are they going to turn to Nutanix when it comes time to fill these gaps? And there's a compelling case to be said.
I think there is. And VMware, as powerful and as solid as they are, they themselves kind of get pulled into that legacy aspect of virtualization. And I think there's something about the way Nutanix is approaching the marketplace that it just feels a little bit different. It's got a simplicity to it. And that's nice to see.
Yeah, we'll have to keep an eye on that. So my final Fast Five actually talks a little bit about Google, Sundar Pichai. And did I say that right? I've never actually said it out loud, but put out an op-ed. So you probably might have heard Tim Cook talking about privacy as a luxury item or a luxury good. And Sundar came out and wrote an op-ed for the New York Times saying, that's not true. It's not a luxury good. So this circles back on this theme of privacy that we've had here on this show. And it's something I'm definitely very interested in personally. His op-ed was very good. But Fast Five item I'm actually talking about is, so Google's launched some new privacy controls that they're very excited about. So when he talked about this, it's not a luxury good, and here's everything we're doing. But after reading about what they've offered, right, which is giving people more choices with their data, things around location tracking, making it easier to turn that off, or a more meaningless incognito mode than what's historically been there. But there's been some insights, and Wired went under the hood and kind of said, this stuff's really hard to use. It's really hard to use. It's not logical. It's not simple. So yes, it's great that they're doing it, but people cannot easily figure it out. And the whole problem with privacy from the get-go, in my opinion, sits a lot on the expectations of the individual to do their diligence, to understand their privacy, to understand how to control it. And so good intentions here from Sundar, a well-written letter, and certainly never hurts to take a swipe at Apple when you're Google. But I'm really kind of finding it laughable as these companies, as Apple, as Facebook, as Google, all stand up and say, we really care about your privacy, when their behaviors really don't mirror that. And so, interesting news. Good to hear they're building more privacy controls. But I have to say, I give it a B- at best, because these companies' privacy and going too far to the slant of privacy is not going to do anything good for these companies' business models. So unless they have another plan, I think it's more lip service to make people feel good than it is intent to build solutions that actually solve the privacy dilemma.
And I think you're right.
Well, good, because I didn't want any feedback there. So we're going to keep going here. We're going to head into our Tech Bite section, and womp womp. Tech does bite sometimes, and we just talked about privacy. We just talked a little bit about things that are going on, and this Tech Bite section isn't exactly about privacy, but it actually zooms into the op-ed that Chris Hughes, one of the founders of Facebook, put out this week. And Fred, I don't know if you read it. A piece came out on The Verge. Casey Newton wrote it, and it talked about Chris Hughes, his kind of op-ed and his discussion around the fact that he thinks Facebook needs to be broken up. He basically thinks Zuckerberg's too powerful. So not the first calling. We've talked about this on the show before from a legislative standpoint, but very interesting to have a former co-founder. Now, Chris Hughes, as a little background, was not a programmer. He's not a coder. He was the empath, they called him, at Facebook, meaning that he was kind of the guy that looked at how people might want to connect. And he brought value to the company by sort of having a very human, anthropologic or sociologic value early on. But now he's basically saying the company's too powerful. Mark has too much control and it needs to be broken up. So what do you think about, Fred? Did you have a chance to read it? And what's your take?
You know, I did. I thought it was very interesting, you know, almost compelling the way he makes his argument there. And it's hard not to take into account the fact that, you know, he was there. I mean, at the very beginning, you know, as this whole juggernaut started to take shape. And, you know, one of the things that that was, you know, in this piece here was, you know, sort of the early signs way back when that, you know, rather than think of Facebook as this, you know, monolithic company growing bigger and stronger, you know, like, you know, the monolith from 2001, Space Odyssey. You know, rather than think of that, his idea was, hey, look, you know, we're doing this so that people can connect. Give every college their own software, their own network. That's their little, you know, Facebook, you know, network. And I think that's all well and good. But what I didn't see here was anything that says, yeah, the company really needs to be split into four parts, you know, that really resonated with me. I do believe that, you know, Zuckerberg as, you know, the CEO and chairman of the firm, bad idea. You know, I'll put that right into the camp with you know, Elon Musk from Tesla. Bad idea there as well. But I think what they need more importantly is rather than being broken apart, I think the company is manageable if they have the right management team in place and if they have sufficient guardrails that keep them on a path that doesn't allow them to do you know, things similar in a way to you know, the Sundar Pichai, you know, from Google. You know, we were talking about earlier, you know, here's my, you know, my letter, my perspective on privacy. You know, I think they're talking to an audience of maybe 10 people that at this point they're all just trying to, you know, give lip service to keep the politicians from trying to step in and legislatively forcing, you know, deep regulation or even breakups, you know, as some of the candidates are talking about today. But anyway, you know, with you know, Chris Hughes here, I thought it was a really interesting piece. I thought he made some really great points. I'm not sure I buy into the breakup model, you know, with this, but I certainly buy into the, you know, the idea that they need to be, you know, regulated. I mean, this engine that they've created is more powerful than, you know, more powerful than the locomotive, faster than a locomotive, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound, you know, Superman. It's huge. And we have to do something to make sure that it's used in an ethical fashion.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I saw this section and it talks about how former Facebook executives are coming out against Facebook's existence in its current form. It talks about Dustin Moskovitz, which He's a top donor for Color of Change, which is basically a campaign to have Zuckerberg fired.
You got to like somebody that has the wherewithal to actually pull something like that off.
Yeah, but he did say out loud that he thinks if the goal is to improve democracy, they need to break up Fox and Sinclair first.
Yes.
Then Mark. Justin Rosenstein, who led the development of the like button, he's warned about the negative effects of social networks on individual psychology. Sean Parker, the first president of Facebook, also known as the Napster. He's quoted as saying, it probably interferes with productivity in weird ways, and God only knows what it's doing to our children's brains. Kamath Palihapitiya, he led their growth team in its early days, told an audience at a Stanford graduate business school to take a hard break from social media. I think we've created tools that are ripping apart the social fabric of how society works. He added that he felt tremendous guilt over his time at the company before walking those comments back after getting an angry phone call from Sheryl Sandberg. Woohoo! And then the last one was Brian Action, who co-founded WhatsApp, but he was not an early executive for Facebook, but he famously told people to delete Facebook upon leaving the company. So there's quite a bit of negativity coming out of the Facebook camp. So this theme isn't going to go away. And if you listen to our show, you're probably going to continue to hear about it either directly and in indirect ways. But the real question is, okay, we've complained a lot about it, but what are we going to do about it? And that's something maybe for another show, another day. And since we're coming towards the end of the show, I'm going to launch hard and fast into our crystal ball. Fred, bottom line question. I'm going to give you a timeline. 12 months out from now.
Yes.
Which company is performing better? Give me both from a stock and a performance standpoint, Uber or Lyft.
Oh, that's a great one. You know, so I think the way to look at that is going to, you know, not be necessarily to look at, you know, the share price, you know, revenue growth, but, you know, really take a look at, you know, what's the EPS, what's the earnings per share moving forward on these guys here. And based on everything I've seen, based on the management team, based on, you know, the market moats that they've kind of built around themselves, or even market focus here, I think Lyft is going to be outperforming from a pure investment perspective. I think they'll be outperforming Uber moving forward. I just don't see Uber really getting their act together. They may have, you know, great, you know, rises in the market cap, but you know, look at that profitability number. I mean, yet true Lyft has their issues, but I think because of their focus in the marketplace and the fact that they're not trying to go into 5 or 10 different, you know, market segments as aggressively as Uber is, and they are focused really heavily on the ride market in the U.S., where Uber has been all over the place and lost all over the place. You know, in some cases, you know, retreating with a piece of the company that kicked them out. But yeah, I'm going to put my money behind Lyft, but I can't say money. I'm going to put my, my virtual money. Yeah. I'm going to say that, I think, Lyft is a better looking company at this point.
And I'm going to be a contrarian here. I actually really have no goodwill towards Uber. And if you've listened to me, read about anything I've written, I've covered it widely. I don't like Uber, but I think Uber has more upside. I think Lyft has narrowed itself down. They're struggling to diversify the business. I don't know if ride sharing in itself is actually a profitable business. I think Uber's further along with autonomous vehicles. I think they've got more of a diversified revenue stream. I think they do have a better leadership in place now. I think they're going to be under pressure at a faster pace because the market, they are the first brand. They are the first name in this business, in this industry. And I think they will potentially turn that corner. I'm actually doing some analysis on the enterprise side around three companies right now, Intel, AMD, and NVIDIA. And I can't say everything I'm going to say about it yet, but I'm looking at the cases for each of those businesses. And let's just say, as I continue to research companies, ecosystem is more important than we want to make it. Yes, being very good in a small area can work for you when you're small. But when you're big, it gets much, much harder to be very successful when you don't have enough total available market at your disposal. So let's leave it on there. I want to thank everybody out there for joining in on this week's edition of Futurum Tech Podcast. Love having you. Olivier, we missed you. So we've mentioned you at least a few times. And everybody out there, if you like the show better without Olivier, let us know because we can find other things for him to do on a Friday afternoon. Just kidding. You have no say. We really appreciate you tuning in to this week's edition. We hope to see you very soon. For Futurum Tech Podcast, Dan Newman, Fred McClymans, we're out of here.
Yeah. There will be plenty of more tech topics and tech conversations right here on the Futurum Tech Podcast, FTP. Hit that subscribe button, join us, become part of our community. We would love to hear from you. Check us out, futurumresearch.com or Futurum Tech Podcast. Daniel Newman, Fred McClymans, Olivier Blanchard. We'll see you later.